This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
Hello, everyone. Good afternoon. It is now afternoon. My name's Matthew Higgins. I'm a senior curator here at the National Museum of Australia. And it gives me great pleasure today to be introducing not only a colleague, but a friend, Dr. Libby Robin, who's a senior research fellow at our Centre for Historical Research. And of course, a senior fellow at the Fenner School of Environment and Society at the ANU. But Libby's been known to the museum for a lot longer than that because she was part of the curatorial team that helped to put together Tangled Destinies, our People and the Environment Gallery, which these days is known as Old New Land. And most of it is reopened following construction work upstairs, so if you've got time today, do go for a wander through it. And Libby, of course, is very well known as a prolific author in both the academic and general readership areas, and her most recent book, How a Continent Created a Nation, won the New South Wales Premier's History Award for Australian History in 2007. And we're very fortunate to have her speaking today on the subject of environmental history beyond the ivory tower, museums, global history and sustainability. Thanks, Libby.
Thank you, Matthew. And Matthew is really doing this environmental history beyond the ivory tower because he's the curator, the senior curator in charge of the environmental history galleries here. So this talk will consider some of the applications of the emerging discipline of environmental history beyond academic journals and university courses. And the reason I'm doing it in this place is we actually have a combination of people here who are doing university courses in environmental history, who were all sitting in a row in the back, I noticed. That's a classic situation. And people who are really doing it here. And also, I noticed with great delight some people from other parts of the museum. Thank you for coming too. So I'm trying to look at how environmental history is being used in places other than in academic journals and the literature we've been talking about all week in our workshop up at the ANU. And the workshop is partly sponsored by the National Museum of Australia. And thank you to the Centre for Historical Research, Peter Stanley's over there, for that sponsorship. So just to give you a quick outline of the talk, I'm going to talk about history and museums in Australia and New Zealand. And if you know more about New Zealand than I do, I'd be very, very grateful because I'm going there soon and I would be glad to get feedback. I want to talk about the evolution of environmental history as a force at the National Museum of Australia and a defining force. And the other two subjects I'm going to touch on fairly briefly at the end. In fact, they look like they're all equal there, but they're not quite. Environmental history and the search for sustainability and why stories of the South matter globally. When I think about the emergence of environmental history in museums, I find myself tracing its prehistory. I don't know if that, it's probably working with Mike Smith that does this, but museums and their critics have had a changing idea about what's a legitimate object for display and ultimately what a museum is for. So I'm going to start with a historical review of how museum fashions have shifted in Australia and New Zealand since the first museums were established in the 19th century in both places. I'm not discussing virtual museums or props or design features. That's sometimes part of the exhibition, but rather the real objects that are chosen, and particularly for bigger museums, the stories they tell of science, of nation, and of society. In the 19th century, museums took their lead from the British and wider European traditions of that time. They focused on natural history, ordering it according to taxonomic and other scientific principles. Even today, in most regional museums, you can find information about the geology, zoology, and to a lesser extent, botany of the region and sometimes of the wider world. Museums function to situate knowledge about biology and geology of place or its region in an international context. They introduce local people to the global context and outsiders to the truly local. So, historically, larger museums focused on animals, particularly large and impressive specimens, sometimes in a habitat created by a diorama, but more often in a cabinet of similar animals. primates together, big cats together, etc. Rocks and minerals were also ordered as crystals or gems of sort of taxonomic display, attractively laid out. Plants often weren't there, because herbaria and botanical gardens historically functioned as a separate realm. They came through a tradition based on physic gardens, specialising in plants grown for medicinal purposes. Colonial botanic gardens were early European signatures in many ports, and they quickly became centres of network and exchange, not just to help sailors suffering scurvy and tropical diseases, but also to grow plants for a pharmacopoeia at home in the metropolitan. So I'm going to go through some of these sort of ways of doing things, but most of the 19th century museums in Australia are about the continent of curiosities. AIA is the Australian Institute of Anatomy, which people in the museum will be familiar with, but it was a historic museum, which I'm going to talk more about later. So we have colonies. We call them states now, but in the 19th century they were colonies, and we have a capital in each of them. The only one that's on that map that shouldn't be there is Launceston, and that's because it was one of the major 19th century museums. They had a great curator there, Ronald Gunn, whose collection became the beginning of that museum as early as 1891. But you can see the purpose, the last column, natural history, was overwhelmingly a purpose of all of them. Geology was also significant in Victoria because it opened at the time of the gold rushes, just right that time. So I'm not going to go through all of those, but you get a sense that the colonial government is the force behind each of them and is using the museum as a way to project what the colony is about, and in a natural history sense. In the uniquely post-Linnaean settlements of Australia and New Zealand, discovered after the Swede Linnaeus had established an order of nature that became the canon of Western taxonomy, curators focused on collecting curious animals that did not fit the preordained categories. Geological specimens were also important because of money. But generally, kangaroos, emus, large avian and marsupial fauna filled the Australian museums and often were displayed alongside the big animals of Africa and Asia, which were the signature of serious European museums. Natural history was the prime reason for a colonial museum, and colonial governments supported that endeavour. In the old world, it was complemented by classical antiquity. In the new world, often technology, and somewhat later, cultural artefacts of indigenous antiquity. So practical technologies associated with measurement and instrumentation for navigating the seas and viewing the skies came with the settlers, while stone tools and hunting weapons, often taxonomically arranged as if they were natural history specimens, represented the older Aboriginal and Maori cultures. And that gives me a cue to talk a little bit about New Zealand's museums. And I'm drawing very heavily on the report by Markham and Oliver, which was made in 1934. Markham did a report here with Richards in 1933, and he was going around all the different colonies and comparing them with each other. He went to South Africa and Canada and various places in the West Indies. Thank you. Julie Phillips has a copy of it in the library if any of you want it. It's terrific. Anyway, New Zealand, in proportion to population, ranked higher than any other British dominion or colony from the museum and art gallery point of view. How many square feet of a museum did you have per population was the sort of way the report is written. And the interesting thing is that in Australia, or in the colonies of Australia, each colony was competing with the other colonies to have an identity. In New Zealand, each city was competing with other cities, not so much colonies. So it was not the government, but rather thousands of enlightened and public-spirited citizens who've pulled together with a delightful sense of teamwork to make their particular town excel. And before 1877, we have Auckland, Christchurch, Nelson, Dunedin, and Wellington had something, but it's very ambiguous whether it was anything until the 1933 Dominion Museum and Art Gallery. It sounds like there were a series of failed efforts there. I haven't quite got to the bottom of that little mystery. But For those of you who don't know New Zealand, those are the places that I'm going to need. So you can see a lot of them are in the North Island, and Christchurch, Dunedin and Invercargill in the south. And I just threw in a random picture. Thought needed a bit of lightening up. In the 1934 report, Markham and Oliver identified the Maori Pa at Rotorua as the first open-air museum in either Australia or New Zealand. And Rotorua, yes, it is on the map, good. By way of comparison, Skansen, Stockholm's outdoor museum zoo, opened in 1891. So that's the Maori Pa was later than that. Maori Pas, or meeting houses, also featured inside museums in Auckland, Otago and Canterbury. Typically, the Maori and Aboriginal materials started after 1901, not earlier. After two world wars, especially the second, when the Western world used science to test the very limits of the possible in the atomic age, museums emerged with a different agenda. As Marianne Halligan put it, a good museum is like a good novel. It brings together objects that prompt the question, how shall we live? You've got to weigh each of those words separately. How shall we live? No longer was the focus on endangered and extinct animals and cultures, but rather the social objects of the dominant culture became the increasing focus of museum collections. Perhaps growing out of earlier local traditions of pioneer and settler, old settler museums, or like Skansen, celebrations of disappearing rural traditions. Social history objects increasingly came from the kitchens and sitting rooms of rural towns and modern suburbia. These objects were designed to trigger those, I remember those, responses in older adults and offered something for intergenerational conversation between family groups. Objects that traced the ways we, rather than they, actually lived, shifted the moral imperatives of the narratives. Some objects express the specifics of a national place and its relations with other places. Hills Hoist clotheslines and Victor lawnmowers were the signatures of 1950s Australian suburbia, along with designer kitchens and clothing. In New Zealand and also in Australia, the maintenance of connections with friends and relations in Britain, Europe and other parts of the world was often carried out by letter, and postcard collections are a recurrent feature of museum displays, underscoring isolation from the metropolitan. Pictures of the marvellous geysers of Rotorua, the rugged mountains of the South Island, especially Mount Cook and the glaciers of Fiordland, emphasised New Zealand's differences from Britain, even though New Zealanders assiduously perpetuated the connections in person as well. They talk about OE, overseas experience. In the olden days, they braved long journeys by ship, and the crockery sets and other memorabilia from ships found their way into museum collections as well. I'm not going to discuss further the displays or the museology, in, for example, the use of cabinets or dioramas or the emergence of what Paul Egerton calls the 1970s shift towards incorporating the visitor-viewer into the dynamics of display. If you want to know more about that, read the latest edition of Recollections online. It's a very good article. But rather, today I'm going to concentrate on the narratives of museum change, which stories get told and which get left out and why. So we get to the 20th century, and I've chosen in the Australian context to look at the national museums. So what makes them national? They're very different in the 20th century from the 19th. The anatomy teaching collection of the Australian Institute of Anatomy, the war history and later art from the War Memorial, the Australian National Botanic Gardens, which was a herbarium, and it was the first botanic gardens for Australian endemic plants, not stuff exchanged, which was the classic colonial botanic gardens. I've put the Northern Territory Museum and Art Gallery there because it was set up by the Commonwealth Government, but it also represents the north of Australia in a way that I think we don't have in other museums to that extent. National Museum of Australia, you can see, is quite late, and I'm going to talk more about that. 1980 was the Act. 2001 was the museum. And life didn't stop with the National Museum of Australia. We've had this big Australian garden open at Cranbourne in Victoria, which is part of the Royal Botanic Gardens of Melbourne. The original gardens there started in the mid-19th century, but the Australian Gardens, 2006, so they've just sort of done the botanic gardens nationally, if you like. In New Zealand, we continue with the smaller pioneer settler model, really. So we had five museums before 1877. By 1934, we've got 10 more, and they're all in little places. The last places, Titirangi and Taihape, forgive me if I'm not saying them right, they have populations of less than 2,000 people, and Markham and Oliver don't think that's enough for a museum. The earthquake in 1931 completely wrecked the museum in Hastings and partially wrecked the one in Napier, but it was still functioning in 34, so I assume that they managed to rescue some of it. Palmerston North, they had a museum and it was defunct. There was one proposed for Hamilton, and I have to find out what's happening with those. It's a very different checkered little story in New Zealand, much more difficult to make big picture statements from. But the significant one, 1996, is Te Papa, the National Museum of New Zealand, which is in Wellington, and was very much used as a model for what we should do for the National Museum of Australia here. Okay, so what should be in a national museum? Just chose a pretty picture for that. In the 1970s, the gap between natural and social history in museums became itself the problem. In the first big review of Australian museums and collections since Markham and Richards, Peter Piggott was asked to chair a committee of inquiry on museums and national collections on the 10th of April 1974. Its primary task was to advise on the scope, objectives and functions of collections, research and displays of historical, cultural and scientific material of cultural significance. The scope of this far-reaching inquiry was shaped by other reformist ventures of the Whitlam government, parallel developments in history, heritage and Aboriginal studies, and especially the idea of a national estate, or things to be owned by the nation. The Australian Heritage Commission was established just as the Piggott Committee was undertaking its inquiry, and it was careful. The Piggott Committee had to distinguish between cultural property, that's collections, and the national estate, which was actually places. But there was a sense that collections were also part of that national estate, if you like. In the era of the Piggott Committee, Aboriginal people were no longer scientific subjects, but rather subjective voices. The stone tool collections of earlier eras were no longer understood as taxonomic assemblages, but rather as cultural artefacts. Aborigines were no longer science. They had social history and increasing control over telling it. Local and living history museums were also on the rise in Australia, but obviously had been going longer in New Zealand. And this was another issue tackled by the committee. Questions of what was local and what was of national significance intertwined. The collections in natural science aroused particular division within the committee. Some saw them as part of the national heritage, and others as crucial to scientific research, and therefore in need of protection from public display. A strong minority view recommended that the natural history collections be managed through an interim council of the biological resources study, rather than placed in a national museum, that might provide a threat to the efficient conduct of our kind of scientific research. That's a quote. Finally, 5 years later, in 1980, the National Museum of Australia Act was passed, enabling a museum that would develop and maintain a national collection of historical material. The museum's research focus was to be on matters pertaining to Australian history. This was a bland simplification of what the Piggott Committee's recommendations were, but this is what they actually said. The theme of the museum should be the history of man and nature in this continent, their linked roles and their interactions. We suggest that divorce man from nature in the new museum would be to perpetuate a schism which the 19th century, in the interests of science, did much to foster. In the years leading up to March 2001, when the museum actually opened, these words in the Piggott report returned to shape the agenda. The National Museum was to be a history museum. The science collections went to science. It would also include a gallery of first Australians, and a gallery that sought to overcome the schism between humanity and the natural world that had been so much the feature of the older style museums. So it was also a point about making it different from the colonial museums. This was where Environmental History Gallery would fit, the place where land and people were displayed together as a story of interdependence, not natural, not social, but a new amalgam, environmental history. And since opening in 2001, lest you think that the National Museum's not doing great new things, in 2007 we have a new commitment to research in the Centre for Historical Research at the National Museum of Australia, and some of us are environmental historians there and some of us are other sorts, so we're just letting you know about that too. The two cultures in museums correspond to the 19th century natural history museums and the 1970s and 80s social history museums, separated along the lines made famous by C.P. Snow's Reed lectures in 1959, but also separated by the era of origin of the museum. The collections that came to the National Museum were, of course, what you had to work with. There were no collections before 1980, but this museum inherited the collections of the Australian Institute of Anatomy, and Sir Colin McKenzie, its first director, had collected these amazing objects in bottles, which I won't dwell on now, but you can see a social history museum has a bit of a problem with objects in bottles. It's a little problem. So they came to the Environmental History Gallery to sort out. The themes were land, nation and people, and there was an effort to try and make all the galleries about all of those. It was conversations between Aboriginal and settler people and conversations between land and nation in all of the galleries. But the curators, generally speaking, were historians, and we did have archaeologists, anthropologists and geographers amongst our team. But I've just been in Denmark, and I was very conscious that most of the curators in the Danish National Museum are archaeologists, and they didn't know what to do with the historian there, so they put me in the natural sciences unit. So I've suddenly become conscious of where people are coming from. Just for people who are new to the subject, environmental history is the study of the interactions between people and nature in the past and how they've changed with time. It treats nature as an actor in history, so an equal, it's not the background to history, but rather one of the subjects of history. Now, by nature, I mean non-human nature. I mean, you could argue with me about that. It's an interdisciplinary endeavour that draws on all those disciplines, and it's sometimes, but not always, stimulated by concern about current environmental problems. So this was the gallery, originally called Tangled Destinies, now called Old New Land. It was 2007, was that right, when it was renamed? Or was it earlier? 2006. I'll fix that slide. You can always do your history as you go along, you see. It's good to have the oracle here. I think that this was the first environmental history gallery in Australia, and it certainly was one of the first in the world. And there have been a lot since, so it's quite interesting where you actually have people and land and nature together. The approach we took, led by our senior curator, was Mike Smith, who I think everybody here knows because he came and talked to us yesterday up at the ANU. He encouraged a history of ideas approach, and we had a loose chronological logic to the three sections. So Natures of Isolation was roughly 18th century, Living with the Land was roughly 19th century, and Understanding Australia was roughly 20th century, though in each of those galleries you found things from other times, so that's not hard and fast. But the message, or the single line, you arrive from somewhere else and find things strange, you make a livelihood, and you've come to scientific and other sorts of understandings in the 20th century when you've been living in a place for some time as you settle into it. Now, obviously, there's a counter-narrative of Aboriginal people who've had the knowledge all along. There's other things. I'm just keeping it pretty simple here. That's a few of the objects. The key first object you met when you came in, which you still meet a version of, is the nest and eggs laid by a warm-blooded animal. And it's still strange today. I mean, even for people who've lived in Australia for many generations, it's weird to think of a platypus laying eggs. So it's a, and it was one of the lovely things that came out of that early collection that was from the Australian Institute of Anatomy. We could use that in that sort of way. I'll be fairly brief on these. I don't need to. Just to show you how the body parts in bottles finally found their way into a gallery, and it became part of the Natures of Isolation. That was actually taken after the opening, but the second group was living with the land. Fire, which is a great technology for being intercultural, obviously. Technologies, that's a buffalo catcher up the top. Wool, wheat and cattle are all represented in different ways. And cities were there too. And, of course, 2003 fires in Canberra are quite a significant part of the gallery now, but they hadn't burnt at the time when the gallery first opened. So that's the background photo. And the 20th century is, well, the Understanding Australia Gallery, which is really the where the history of ideas comes to the forefront most strongly, because the idea of Gondwana, the idea of climate change, not just as a new political movement, but climate change over the drying out of the dead heart of Australia. Environmental politics is there, and a sense of place. At the bottom, the picture hasn't come out terribly well, but it's the lexicon of Australia and the words, the Aboriginal words, and the ways settler Australians, the words mean different things. Jay Arthur's not here, but we drew heavily on her work. You know, a river isn't really, it doesn't have to flow all the time to be a river in Australia. In fact, it mightn't have any water in it in a river in Australia. That sort of thing is featured in those panels. Just to give you an idea, there's a lovely gallery when I went to Western Australia, which was called Country, Visions of Land and People in Western Australia, and Matthew Trinker, who I think isn't here today, but he was part of the team that did that terrific book. But it's a little alarming if you look at the website today. It seems to be all about dinosaurs. So I've just put up the bit at the bottom is exactly what's on the web page, and it's not at all what it looked like when I was there. So I've shown you a picture of the dinosaurs. It seems like they've gone for even deeper time there than our Diprotodon. I also want to talk about environmental history in other museums, and this is a very interesting museum, a fishery and seafaring museum. I won't try and say it in Danish. In Esbjerg, in the western coast of Denmark, and this is the place, the Esbjerg is the place where they developed seine nets for fishing, which actually came to the New South Wales fisheries in 1931 and had completely fished them out by about 2 or 3 years ago. And the same problem happened there. The North Sea fisheries collapsed, and this is a whole really big town built on it, not just fisheries, but also boat building, net making. They exported nets all over the world, and suddenly the whole town didn't have an industry because there were no fish left. So they have a museum instead. A maritime environmental history of fisheries collapse and then social consequences. It's quite political, it's quite overt, and it's very well done. And they have a beach section outside. Like a lot of Scandinavian museums, it's an inside and outside museum, so that's why I've given you a bit of an idea of how they do different things. And the albatrosses, well, no, they're not albatrosses, they're smaller than that. The seabirds caught in the nets, tuna fishing nets, are featured in the museum too. So there is quite a bit of overt politics there. Okay, so that leads me on to environmental history and the search for sustainability. Because the issues of sustainability are in places other than museums as well, I thought I should talk about just briefly about some of those, particularly the World Congress, the first ever World Congress of Environmental History, which is going to be in Copenhagen next year. history and sustainability initiative that I'm working on with some people in the UK and elsewhere, and the Integrated History of and Future of People on Earth project, which is part of the new ANU Climate Change Institute, which is being launched by the Vice-Chancellor right now, which is why none of my department has been able to come. That's up at... so that I hope is going to be one of the projects of that new institute. So to take them in order, I think some people here are already coming to this Congress in Copenhagen, but I think it's going to be a very interesting opportunity for people who are writing environmental history in different countries to meet each other. And environmental history isn't the same animal in different countries. We've been talking about this a little in our workshop. So in America, it's very much motivated by ideas of wilderness and ideas of frontier history meeting each other in the 1970s and has remained pretty much with history departments. In Australia and New Zealand, it's a lot of people who do environmental history would define themselves primarily as scientists. And increasingly, there are people who are interdisciplinary, who are trained originally in science, who are coming into to environmental history. So I think Europeans, have a bit of both and maybe a slightly different take on each. So it's going to be interesting. And I hope we get some people from Africa and India and China, where environmental history means very different things again, and a lot bigger social justice agendas in those places. So I'm hoping that we'll get a good mixture of people. But since I've read 177 abstracts, I can tell you that there's going to be some interesting things coming to it. I think there's going to be 600 presenters, so it's a huge thing. The difficulty is going to be getting the people together. Now, this is a completely different initiative. This one came from the Education Department of the UK, which deals with higher ed, secondary ed and primary ed all together. And they are looking for a theme that cross-cuts all the sectors of education, and they've come up with sustainability. And they, because they're in Britain, they think history should be teaching this, which is an interesting... because the British tend to turn to their humanities for these sort of initiatives. So we have a very interdisciplinary group working with this, with a number of Scandinavians. I'm from Australia, and there's a group from Harvard who I haven't met, but apparently are also working in this. But they asked me to speak at a conference, and I thought, what am I going to talk about that can appeal to all those levels of education? And this is what I came up with. I went to a musician, and he talks about the idea of the big here and the long now, the globalisation and the human imagination. So how do you imagine the whole world as your place? And this is Brian Eno. Now is never just a moment. The long now is the recognition that the precise moment you're in grows out of the past and is a seed for the future. And the longer your sense of now, the more in past and future it includes. And so the idea of stretching the now, makes a very political role for history. And I want to talk just for the last bit about why stories of the South matter globally. And I'm being a bit naughty here because I'm talking about Australia, and we're not usually classified as a South nation in the sense that people don't seem to worry about geography, it's all about economics. But I've got Aboriginal Australians in fire because I think they speak very strongly to this Integrated History and Future of People on Earth project, which began in Dahlem in Germany in 2005, and they produced this publication, Sustainability or Collapse, an Integrated History and Future of People on Earth. And they are interested in the history of societies that are sustainable and societies that have collapsed. And most of the stuff they had written about in this period were the ones that had collapsed. Jared Diamond obviously was very influential on the thinking of the group. And the original group didn't have any historians involved at all. They were what you'd call global change, or they call themselves global change bureaucrats, really. They worked for the United Nations, and they were trying to look at justice, but historically. Because it began with a group from North America and a group from Europe, the big story that it worked with was the idea that the Ice Age came, and when the ice melted, the people moved in. That's the big story. So whether you're in North America or in Europe, that's the big story. But of course, as Mike Smith's work shows, we had people living here through the Ice Age, throughout the Ice Age, and we didn't have glaciation in the Ice Age, which would have improved our topsoil, but we have a completely different story because we don't have glaciation in the Ice Age. We have people living through that period. So that's why you can't talk about global history and say everybody, the ice melted and people moved in, is the global story. And that's the way it was being pictured before the Australian contribution. And it's now not being pictured that way. And there are obviously other stories from other places, and Australian Aboriginal, the sustainable living in the land through climate change is a big story for these people. And there's a new resilience centre. I think this is going to be the new word. Brian Walker was here talking about this about a month ago. It's going to be the new word rather than sustainability. And the interesting thing about resilience is that it requires ecosystems that are not efficient. So it's actually you're looking for duplication rather than for maximisation of output under resilience. So there's a whole lot of very interesting philosophical thinking going behind this so-called history project. And I just think it's quite fun that environmental history gives us a way as a museum to engage with this work and gives environmental historians another platform to consider their work. There's some further reading there, but I'll just finish with this concluding remarks. If David Lowenthal and Donald Borster are right, environmental history has the potential to close the gap between the humanities and the sciences, the environmental sciences in particular. Worster has referred to the process as the search for common ground, of finding open doorways through the walls of specialisation that divide us. So we are opening a door in the wall that separates nature from culture, science from history, matter from mind. Where we are arriving is not at some point where all academic boundaries and distinctions disappear, but one where those boundaries are more permeable than before. Jane Carruthers, the South African historian, used this quote in a recent talk in South Africa about the state of the discipline. But it applies even more sharply to museums, where environmental history is called on to play what Sveka Sulin and Paul Vorder call a translatory role between disciplines. Jane Carruthers commented on the excitement of that common ground, or the thrill of finding the connections, the challenge of the synthesis. Museums, heritage, environment protection, music, climate change and globalisation are all seeking a craft of synthesis, a conversation between human and non-human nature with a deep time depth. The pressure is on environmental historians to be flexible, inclusive and offer its insights in many ways. Thank you.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.